Obviously, the New York Times is listening to this program. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, very good friend, Chuck Michael.
Barry, it is great to be back with you. Today was absolutely beautiful, and of course we're recording this on Sunday night. But today was just unbelievable. Just like, didn't even have to wear a jacket to go to church this morning.
Well, that's good, and yes, it was beautiful in my neck of the woods as well. But you know what, Chuck? What I've got to be thinking is that somewhere in the deep, 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 deep south, if you really understand the allusion that I'm making, there must have been an ice storm. Because we found out, as we looked over the weekend, a column in the opinion pages of all places, the New York Times, which, Chuck, I think you and I are both a little stunned, seems to agree with our take on the real reason for the Rand Paul filibuster and the underlying rationale we talked about over the weekend.
Yeah, I think you might say that the huge crackling sound that you heard was the sound of the nether regions freezing over.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was referencing, yes. Well, you see, ladies and gentlemen, in an article, an op-ed contributor in the New York Times editor opinion pages, on this would have been over the weekend, that Ryan Goodman, who wrote this piece called The Drone Question Obama Hasn't Answered, seems to agree pretty strongly with what we here at the Institute for Principal Policy and on this program has said over the last few days about this problem. Now, Goodman, for a little background, is a professor of law and the co-chairman for the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at New York University. And part of the reason why he's writing for the New York Times, I suppose, is because of that pedigree of his. But he's talking about the whole issue of the Rand Paul filibuster on the floor of the Senate on Wednesday and said, well, you know what? They did confirm John Brennan as the Central Intelligence Agency on Thursday. But before the vote, he said that Rand Paul received, as he put it, a somewhat odd letter from the Attorney General. And we talked about that letter on our previous program and how it was worded. And it seems like we weren't the only ones, Chuck, who had a little issue with the way phrasing was used in that reply. Because the editorial writer, Mr. Goodman, basically said that even though Rand Paul said, quote, that he was quite happy with the answer, he says, Holder's letter raises more questions than it answers, and indeed, more important and more serious questions than the senator posed. And then he says exactly what we said. What exactly does the administration mean by, quote, engaged in combat?
Yeah, exactly. Now, can I make a comment on this real quick? I think that Rand Paul's answer, that he thinks that he was happy with that answer. Well, I'm going to ask you now, what do you think that means? Because the way I read it is, okay, fine. You've given me this answer. It's nuanced. You've given me more ammunition for later.
Well, that's kind of the way I perceive Rand Paul's answer. Not that, that satisfied all of my concerns, and therefore I'm good to vote on John Brennan. I think what he was basically saying is, this is kind of where I thought you were going to go to with this, so thank you for confirming it and putting it in writing.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I think he was going. Now, yeah. That being, one question I don't see addressed here, and this guy's a law professor, so he should have thought of this as well. Remember, this question that we asked was two-pronged. Who decides what combat is and who's engaging in it? And why do American citizens, why are they not being guaranteed, even if they're combatants, a trial by jury? Because that is a constitutional guarantee. So where is that? The answer is, he's kind of asking it in a sidelong fashion. And the reason I say that is because he talks about the definition of people that came out back in 2004 under the Bush administration. The Pentagon released a list of the types of people it was holding at Guantanamo Bay as enemy combatants, a list that included people who were, quote, involved in terrorist financing, unquote. Well, Barry, I've got a problem with that. If they're American citizens, that is a treasonous act.
Yes, it is. And there is a constitutional remedy for that treasonous act.
Now, you know what these all go back to? These all go back to trials that were done during the Civil War. The precedent goes back to the Civil War. Military tribunals trying American citizens and going so far as to expel from the country, absolutely unconstitutionally, a sitting congressman from the state of Ohio. And he was deported to Canada.
Clement the Landingham, yes.
This shows you the bankruptcy of depending on precedent, because no one did anything about it. Congress did not do its job, and we have to remember who was in charge of Congress at the time, and that was the very radical Republican element who created Reconstruction, which was also unconstitutional. They were willing to do anything that they could to ensure that more power was vested in the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting you brought that particular point up, Chuck, because it also lends to, since we're using that Civil War analogy, something I'm going to suggest a movie to our listeners to watch when they get a chance to watch, called The Conspirator. It was filmed here about 2 or 3 years ago, and it's basically a dramatization of the trial of Mary Surratt, whose son was involved with John Wilkes Booth and the plot to assassinate then-President Lincoln. And I think that's an interesting piece because it shows you what the administration and military courts will do to those who are, shall we say, ancillary to the crime in some way.
And, of course, if you don't know the story of Mary Surratt, she was executed.
Yes, she was killed for her role in that, which basically was that people met at her boarding house where her son lived.
And she was not tried by a jury of her peers, and two witnesses were not produced in order to achieve a guilty plea. She was tried by a military tribunal.
That's right. That's right. Now, the editorial writer, Mr. Goodman, keeps going in this piece, and he starts talking about, he goes, well, the extraordinary secrecy of this White House, the Obama White House, makes the answer of what do they mean by engaged in combat difficult to know. He says, we have some clues, and they are troubling. And he says that basically if you put together the pieces of publicly available information, that the Obama administration, like the previous administration, has acted with an overly broad definition of what it means to be, quote, engaged in combat. And then he starts talking about the Bush era and the list of the types of people in Guantanamo, which you remember when Barack Obama was campaigning. One of his big things was ending all that Guantanamo Bay, and continuing on to say, well, you know, wait a minute. That didn't apply to targeting for a drone strike, but then he says, who's to say if the administration believes in such a distinction?
Well, that's a great question.
So here is somebody, Chuck, a law professor at New York University, who's the co-chair of the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice. So I wouldn't necessarily say this guy's listening to Rush Limbaugh and watching Fox News on a regular basis, if you know what I'm saying. I think he's probably fairly left to center. But even the left now is starting, as they say, the blush is off the rose. And I believe that Barack Obama is starting to have the same problems with his pom-pom shaking friends in some of the media as George Bush was having during his second administration with some of the conservative media. When you get a president into his second term of office, his last term of office, he knows this is his legacy and he's actually got to do what he believes he wants to do. And so, therefore, instead of nuancing things and couching stuff because you're running for re-election, you're actually showing what your governing philosophy really is. And I believe that, at least from this editorial, that the New York Times is signaling that they've seen a glimpse of what Barack Obama's true governing philosophy is in this second administration, and they're starting to get very, very concerned about it. And like I said, it's similar to Bush's second term here, when a lot of conservative media saw that, well, George Bush wasn't nearly as conservative as they had all had lionized him to be.
Well, anybody who paid attention during his first term, I mean, that's when No Child Left Behind got passed. The Kennedy-Boehner Act, as I recall that was called back in the day. There's two paragraphs here that I find very interesting. In a 2010 Fox News interview under pressure to explain whether the Obama administration was any closer to capturing or killing Osama bin Laden, Mr. Kerry's predecessor, Hillary Rodham Clinton, said that, quote, we have gotten closer because we have been able to kill a number of their trainers They're operational people. They're financiers. Now, the author says that that revelation killing financiers appears not to have been noticed very widely. No, because everybody's got their hands over their ears saying la, 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 la.
Exactly.
But the next paragraph, as I have written, sweeping financiers into a group of people who can be killed in armed conflict stretches the laws of war beyond recognition. But this is not the only stretch the Obama administration seems to have made. The administration still hasn't disavowed its stance, disclosed last May in a New York Times article, that military-age males killed in a strike zone are counted as combatants absent explicit posthumous evidence proving otherwise.
So in other words, they could be killing civilians and counting them as combatants so that it looks better for them.
Yeah, not only that, they're guilty until proven innocent. What does that have to do with any form, military or otherwise, form of justice in the United States of America or even outside its borders? The answer is, it bears no resemblance to any kind of philosophical or theological way of dealing with people you suspect of being combatants. You prove the case and then you kill them. So we've got a number of things going on here. And again, he's talking about existing laws of war where combatants can be killed. And I still say, constitutionally, anyone, even if they declare themselves a combatant, who's a United States citizen on United States soil, has the right to a trial by jury in a treason trial. Now, if he's engaging in some act, if he's actively shooting things or bombing people or whatever, okay, you can use a drone to take them out as a shootout, an attempt to stop the action, and in a shootout type situation, kill him or allow him to kill, and he's actively in the act. Because, you know, a police officer can kill someone to stop them from killing someone else. It scales up. What doesn't scale up, if a cop goes around and everybody he suspects of possibly being a criminal, he just simply shoots them. Well, that doesn't scale up. Or what actually it does, because the prohibition scales up. And that's the problem we're dealing with, Barry. And in fact, a lot of the people that we're dealing with in the conservative movement can't seem to grasp that. Anybody who's deemed to be a member of this and that and another organization, no matter what part of the organization they're in, is automatically a criminal and liable to be murdered. Now, that's not the way this works.
Well, no, and the point is that we have to stick to what the Constitution explicitly says. Now, you know, over the weekend, I was also on Facebook a little bit and was looking at a couple of threads from otherwise very conservative friends of mine who were, in some senses, trying to justify making it okay for the president to have some unilateral authority in certain hypothetical circumstances to be able to just pick people out to be killed. And I think I kind of lost my composure in writing online. I'm like, whoa, 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 wait a minute here. First of all, it's either a situation of war or treason if it's an American citizen. And then in war, who is it? Which branch declares war? There's only one under the Constitution. And I'll leave it our listeners to think about this. Who declares war? Secondly, which branch has the responsibility under our form of government, under our Constitution, for trying and convicting of treason? And what are the standards for being able to declare someone treasonous? There's only two ways you can do it. And then at that point, then you ask the other question, well, if that's the case and they find someone treasonous, then who is it, which branch sets the penalty or the punishment for treason? Because that's it, Chuck. I mean, it isn't the president sitting in a room with a handful of advisors saying, well, we believe that Joe Smith's raw milk farm is actually going to fund an Al-Qaeda cell. So Joe Smith's on our list. Now let's go send an unmanned drone with a bomb on it to blow up Joe Smith's cows. You know,
well,
that's not how we're supposed to operate in this country under a form of government.
And that's the kind of legal reasoning, though, that you get out of the administration when they want to be a judge, jury, and executioner.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right.
We're basically out of time here.
Oh, okay.
Couldn't shock you. We're always out of time when we want more. So I'm going to say we're going to discuss something a little bit different tomorrow, but not all that much different. So join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policy.